The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Overwhelmingly, millennials are in favor of socialism, or at least they have a very positive view of socialism. Millennials don't know who people like Pol Pot or Stalin or Mao are, which is kind of, to me, what being a millennial is all about, like all of the enthusiasm with none of the knowledge.
Hey, and welcome. This is the Ben Shapiro Show Sunday Special. We have Lauren Chen from the Blaze TV joining us. We'll get to her in just one second. But first, I know this is a really awkward thing to talk about, but sex, particularly within marriage, is one of the crucial aspects of a healthy life. And like any other aspect of your health, sometimes things don't work the way they're supposed to. That's not something to be ashamed about. It's something to get fixed. And that's where our friends at Roman come in. Studies show that 70% of dudes who experience erectile dysfunction don't get treated for it, thankfully. Roman created an easy way to get checked out by a doctor and get treated for ED online. Roman is a one-stop shop where licensed U.S. physicians can diagnose ED and ship medication directly to your door. With Roman, there are no waiting rooms or awkward face-to-face conversations or uncomfortable trips to the pharmacy. You can handle everything discreetly online. All you have to do is visit GetRoman.com/Ben and complete a dynamic online visit. Chat with a doctor. Get genuine medication delivered to your door in discreet, unmarked packaging. Dudes, just go online, get checked by the doctor. Erectile dysfunction is a problem that guys don't tend to tackle. But with Roman, it's pretty simple. So go take care of it right now. For a free online visit, go to GetRoman.com/Ben. That's GetRoman.com/Ben for a free online visit. Once more, GetRoman.com/Ben. Don't let the problem wait. GetRoman.com/Ben. Lauren, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's just jump right in with a little bit of your background. For folks who don't know your work or how you became a host on Blaze TV, take me from what you were, which was sort of a YouTube host, to being on Blaze TV and having a large following and all of this.
Sure. Well, I started my YouTube channel. It's going to be 3 years ago in May, and I was just uploading videos, you know, once or twice a month just for fun. There were little dinky slideshow presentations that I did about social issues. I did one on the minimum wage, and it was really just a side hobby. But eventually, I started to get more subscribers and more popular and kind of got enough of a following where I could make that my full-time job. And then last year, I ended up starting a show with CRTV, which is now the Blaze TV. And so, yeah, right now we do 3 episodes a week. Everything's on YouTube for people to see if they want to subscribe to Lauren Chen. And we kind of talk about cultural issues more so than political ones right now, just because I feel like as someone who is a millennial and who's trying to reach out to people around my age, the cultural issues are really where most of the focus is when we're talking about what affects people in their day-to-day lives on social media, in their college classes, the films and stuff they have to deal with. That
so
sort of thing.
You're a genuine millennial. I'm like at the very tail end of the millennials. I get to technically slide in right under the wire.
Yeah.
You're a millennial. How old are you?
I am 24.
Okay.
So it's still okay to ask me that. I'm young enough where it's not.
Right. It's not insulting.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
I knew that it wasn't insulting, so I could ask you that. So how did you become conservative at age 24?
So growing up, my family was pretty apolitical. I mean, we didn't really talk about politics. I grew up in Asia, so the politics wouldn't have been the same anyway. But we didn't really talk about anything to do with like taxes or anything like that. But just socially, I came from a family. Maybe it's, you know, the Asian dad influence that I have. That was just very pro-family, pro-hard work, pro-individual responsibility. So I think socially, I was always kind of naturally conservative. And then when I started to get into politics just on my own, I feel like those values just naturally lent themselves to me being, you know, pro-individual liberty and freedom, i.e. conservative. When I started college at 17, I was in the College Republicans at USC, one of, I think, like 35 of us out of a campus of 60,000. I never really had a moment where I was liberal and then changed, which I think is maybe rare for people who are my age. And I think a lot of that just had to do with my family's outlook on things rather than, I don't like to think that I'm brainwashed, but I was just raised with a certain set of values that I think when translated into government do favor conservatism over liberalism.
So I'm going to ask you a version of a question that I get all the time. I get asked all the time because I'm Jewish, why do so many Jews vote for the left? So I'm going to ask you, why do so many folks who are Asian vote for Democrats, considering that it is a lot of Democratic policies that seem to be cutting against the interests of a lot of Asian folks who are the number one earning by household group in the United States who are systematically disadvantaged on college campuses by affirmative action programs disproportionately. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that's happening?
I think it's happening because the left has very, very, intelligently crafted a narrative where people say that Republicans and conservatives are racist. They hate immigrants. They hate Asian people. So it only makes sense to vote for Democrats, which is frustrating because if you actually talk to, people in the Asian community, they're pro-small business. So many Asian immigrants own small businesses themselves. Socially, they're also conservative. There's not really much in the Democratic platform that appeals to Asian people en masse, aside from the idea that conservatives are racist and hate them for their skin color, which is obviously false. So, I like to try and bring up as much as possible how, like you said, Democrats and progressives, they really aren't for Asians because Asians are, if we're looking at the oppression hierarchy, doing even better than white people. So we see, time and time again, when it comes to things like affirmative action, they're happy to throw Asians under the bus for the interests of like other more special minority groups. It's really frustrating me that so many Asians are, falling for it.
So you have a multi-ethnic background. You've lived in a lot of countries other than the United States. How's that shaped your view of both the United States generally and then race in the United States? You know, contrasting, you've lived in Canada. You've mm-hmm. lived, obviously, in Asia. How does that shape your view of the United States? And then on sort of the racial polarization scale, where do you think the U.S. is right now?
Well, economically, the way living in Asia has shaped my point of view. I've lived in Singapore and Shanghai and Hong Kong, obviously very economically prosperous country places and cities. But I've also visited places like Thailand and Indonesia, which are developing countries. So my background, what it means to me is that I understand what actual poverty looks like, not, millennial, I have college loans, therefore I think capitalism is broken type poverty. So I think that perspective has been really important to me because, you hear a lot of Democrats who are essentially socialists now disparaging capitalism and saying that, the American dream is dead. If you look at other countries, the U.S. is doing extraordinarily well. There's no denying that. So I think that perspective has been important. And in terms of race relations, it's funny because, growing up, obviously, I've been mixed race the entire time. There's never a time where I was not mixed race. It's just been part of my reality. It was never something that I really thought about. I never thought it was strange. It was just like, my mom's white and Canadian. My dad's Chinese. It is what it is. I'm both. The first time I was really confronted with the American interpretation of race was when I found myself on American campus. And I realized how, although the U.S. is absolutely one of the least racist places I've ever been, and I think, when they do studies about approval rates for things like interracial marriages, it's consistently one of the least racist places in the world. There's no denying that. But it is also one of the places that's most obsessed with race, which is really, really strange to me. For the amount of actual racists there are in the United States, i.e. very few, it seems like we're talking about race a disproportionate amount.
So before you were sort of the pseudo-intellectual, that's the name of your show, over at Blaze TV, you're roaming millennial, so your brand is very tied into the millennials. What is it the millennials are not getting about American politics that so many of them are trending towards socialism and radicalism and intersectionality?
Well, it's funny because we've done videos about this. If you look at polls, overwhelmingly millennials are in favor of socialism, or at least they have a very positive view of socialism. But if you actually probe them a little bit deeper, most or at least a good number of millennials don't know who people like Pol Pot or Stalin or Mao are. So it's funny because we're very, very warm toward socialism as an ideology, but at the same time, we don't know anything about socialism as an ideology, which is kind of, to me, what being a millennial is all about, all of the enthusiasm with none of the knowledge. So I think if we kind of try to break down millennial politics, it's all about trying to do what feels good and what seems fair and righteous, but that's not necessarily backed up in history and economic fact. And I think ultimately it's a failure of education. Millennials don't know enough about the world and the system that they're soon going to be in charge of running, and that's scary.
What do you think is the best way for conservatives to reach out? So obviously, we're both speaking to a young audience, a disproportionately young audience. My feeling has been that a lot of conservative leaders have not actually done the hard work of talking about ideas. It's been a lot of sort of follow the leader. Where do you think conservatives can do better? Where is their upside for conservatives in talking to young people?
Well, I think if we look at Gen Z right now, they are more conservative than any generation has been in a long time. And I think we really need to capitalize on that. But I don't think we can win the battle of ideas without engaging in culture more than we have in the past. People like you are doing a great job because without conservative commentators, you have to understand the average millennial, the school that they go to, it's preaching progressivism. The media that they watch, the films and TV series that they watch, it's all enforcing this one idea. So unless we have any media of our own to kind of counter it, then it's just natural that these people are going to end up believing what everyone else around them is saying, which is that, the U.S. is an oppressor, capitalism is evil, socialism is what's fair, et cetera, et cetera. In the future, I think if we actually want things to be a bit more balanced in terms of what children are learning growing up, and I'm not saying that we need to counteract liberal brainwashing with conservative brainwashing, but we do need to try and make school more about learning ideas and critical thinking rather than just feeding them regurgitated talking points.
One of the things that I've found is sort of a gap between young conservatives and older conservatives is on the issue of President Trump. So
Right. It
seems like a lot of older conservatives are very much believers in everything that President Trump does. They've decided in many cases that his foibles and his personality quirks, to say the least, that those are secondary to his promulgation of policy. And they don't seem to understand that President Trump is deeply unpopular among young people. How do you grade President Trump so far? And what's the best way to talk about President Trump to young people?
I like President Trump a lot, and I'm not going to try to make excuses for everything he's ever tweeted. I would hate that job. I mean, I don't know how the people in his press office do it. Thinking about it just gives me anxiety. But I think he's done a very good job in terms of what he's promised and things that haven't been delivered upon, like healthcare reform and the wall, for example. I don't see as exclusively his fault. So overall, I'm a big supporter, and I think when it comes to trying to talk about him to young people, it's about trying to strike a balance between, all right, do you want someone who has all of the like ideals that we wish Trump had but is ineffective and nothing done policy-wise, or do you want someone who, for all of his faults, is doing more to progress a conservative agenda in government than anyone has in a long time? And it's not a perfect choice. It's not the best choice that I wish people had, but it is ultimately the situation that we're in. And I think when we're talking to young conservatives, I found that they like President Trump because he's not afraid to tackle things like the mainstream media. I mean, I'm not saying he does it with the most nuance and tact, but he's at least not afraid to talk about it. He's not afraid to talk about things like trade deals or instances where the U.S. is maybe, I'm not sure being taken advantage of is the right term, but maybe not having a fair deal. And ultimately, I think young people do appreciate that he's willing to engage in meme culture. And, the wall is coming meme, that was very, very popular.
I mean, for folks who don't understand, maybe you can sort of explain to people what exactly meme culture is. I know there's a subsection of the audience that knows, but maybe you can sort of define this, because this is a very millennial thing.
Yeah, okay, so memes are kind of an inside joke that everybody is in on. And we see, like, leading up to 2016, that memes were a large part of how millennials were engaging in the political conversation. They're taking things that different candidates have said and making it into a joke. And, to a lot of people who are like, no, we need to focus on policy, blah, 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 that may seem immature and childish, which I'm not saying that it's not, but it's a way that people are able to, feel more a part of the conversation and to engage and to make it into almost like a joke or something fun that people can get interested in. So it's not exactly the highest form of political participation, but it is something. And so for young people, and I think Trump understands this, like we're very into whatever's on social media. So politics, if it wants to survive and specific candidates as well, then they need to be willing to engage in that social media presence, which Trump is, for better or worse. We also see candidates like AOC having a lot of success there, Beto as well, and actually Dan Crenshaw is one of the few conservatives, I think, that really gets how important it is to have a presence on places like Twitter.
So can you explain, I think, for folks, you've talked about AOC's popularity and the fact that she's quite popular. I get the feeling you're irritated by it the same way that I am. But what exactly do you think it is that makes her popular, for example? What differentiates her from the typical politician?
Well, I mean, she's younger, obviously. She checks all the right demographic. She's not white. She's a woman. She's a millennial. So that all looks good for them. But also, I mean, for all of her faults, which she obviously has a lot of them in terms of just knowledge of how economics work, she is at least addressing issues that matter to millennials. And I think, policy-wise, Republicans can talk about things like, business regulations and income tax breaks, and that's great. And for a large part of the population, that's going to resonate with them. But when you're talking about millennials specifically, it's like, look, Most millennials, or at least a good amount of them, probably not paying income tax to begin with. Most of them, not small business owners, so that doesn't affect them. What does affect them? Things like healthcare and, college debt. They care about the environment. For better or worse, AOC is talking about those issues, which Republicans, by and large, are not. And she's not only she's talking about them, but she's doing that on Instagram Live, which millennials love. So it's kind of natural that people are flocking to her.
So let's talk about climate change for a second, because obviously this has been a very popular point of view for her, at least among young people. Not so popular among anyone else, considering got zero votes in the Senate.
Yeah.
And her poll numbers, by the way, for all of her popularity among a subset, her poll numbers have basically tanked. Her polls number, she's well below 50% in sort of popularity polling. She has high name recognition. People are beginning, I think, to grow irritated with her. But there's been a lot of talk in the Democratic Party about climate change. How do you think conservatives ought to talk about climate change? Because it seems like particularly older conservatives are simply denying that it's taking place, they suggest that the science is so deeply flawed that there's no way to know. And then there's sort of another wing, and I count myself among this wing, of folks who say that climate change, anthropogenic climate change, is taking place, but the kinds of solutions that are being posed by the left are not only foolish, they're counterproductive. What do you think is the best way to talk about the climate change issue with young people?
Well, I'm definitely one of those people who loves the environment. I don't like pollution. I would like to consider myself a conservationist. And I think the issue with the environment right now is that the issue with climate change isn't, I mean, in my opinion, whether or not the climate is going to change in such a way that we're all dead in 12 years, which I really don't think it is. But even without that, pollution is still not a good thing. So I think we need to be focused more on pollution, which we have, we have evidence about what the short-term effects are to the environment, rather than trying to predict what may or may not happen in 10, 15, whatever years. Because I'm like you, I do believe that mankind is contributing to climate change, but I think what we've seen time and time again are that the predictive models they've tried to graph have not been accurate. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't care about the environment, though, and I think what Republicans and conservatives should try to do is put forth solutions or methods of trying to address pollution that are not just full on socialism or communism. Let's implement UBI and get rid of all the planes, which is what, AOC is trying to do. So I think things like solar, there's been a lot of developments in solar energy in the private sector that make it very appealing for individuals just to, because of, their own interests or their own budget, install in their own homes. I think conservatives should be trying to encourage people in, free market, private enterprise types of ways to do what they can as individuals to combat climate change. Because otherwise, if the Democrats are the only people talking about it, then I think a lot of especially young people are going to think that if you want to do something, anything for the planet, then you have to vote for them because Republicans don't care, which I don't think is true. There are a lot of Republicans who do care about the planet.
So in a second, I'm going to ask you, because you are both a biological woman and identify as a woman.
I think you're making some assumptions there, sir.
Okay, well, that's awkward then. But I'm going to ask you about some women's issues in just a second. But first, can you believe it's already April? Time has a habit of getting away. But if you have a mortgage or kids or anyone, depending on your income, you're going to have to spend some of that precious time getting life insurance. If you need life insurance, but you don't want to spend a lot of time comparing it, you should give Policy Genius a try. Policy Genius is the easy way to buy life insurance online. In just 2 minutes, you can compare quotes from the top insurers and find your best price. Once you apply, the Policy Genius team will handle all the paperwork and the red tape. No commissions, no hidden fees, just more time saved for you. And Policy Genius doesn't just make life insurance easy. They also make it easy to find the right home insurance, auto insurance, disability insurance. They're your one-stop shop for financial protection. So if you need life insurance, but you're short on time, head on over to policygenius.com and compare quotes. Policy Genius is easy. It saves you money. And not to belabor the point, but it is fast. Policy Genius. Spend less time comparing life insurance. Spend more time doing literally anything else. Policy Genius. Go check it out right now. That's policygenius.com. It is going to allow you to get that life insurance or home insurance or any other insurance you want. Policy Genius, the best way to get life insurance. Alrighty, so let's talk about the fact that you are a woman. Mm-hmm. And as a woman, this means that you have great insight into a wide variety of issues to which I apparently cannot speak. I have been told by many. So let's talk about the fact that women in the West have it better than any women in the history of humanity. And yet polls seem to show that women are becoming less and less happy over time. Why do you think that is happening?
I think it's because feminism has spun a narrative that tells women that they're oppressed and that men are the oppressors, and that the only way for them to gain independence and freedom and liberation, and I think therefore happiness, is to kind of break free from all of the institutions that have ironically ensured that the West has become such a great place, things like marriage and motherhood. And it's actually pretty depressing to me to look at that because I place so much value on femininity and womanhood and anything that goes with that, that it hurts me on a personal level to see feminism just so keen to, I guess, disparage and dismiss what traditionally has made women kind of the moral gatekeepers of societies in a lot of ways.
I mean, it is truly puzzling to me. You know, I'm married, obviously. I have a couple of kids. Mm-hmm. And my wife, who is a doctor, also...
I hadn't heard.
Yeah, she also cool. spends a fair bit of time at home with the kids. And as soon as she is done with her residency, it'll be a wildly increased amount of time at home with the kids. And that's what she wants to do. I'm always puzzled by the feminist argument that women are happier if they're not married and they don't have kids. I've yet to see evidence of this proposal at work.
No, there really isn't any. And what's so scary, I think, to think of is that among my mom's friends especially, she does know a lot of women who she's been working with. And throughout their 20s and 30s, early 30s rather, they were happy to dedicate their entire lives to their career. They were saying, yeah, I don't need kids. I don't need a husband. Happy just myself. But the thing with women is that when it comes to childbearing, unlike men, we do have a little bit of a, you know, like an expiration date where we need to get going on things if we want children to happen. Unfortunately, for a lot of women, once they're at the point in their lives where they realize, wait, motherhood is something that I want, a family is something that I want, for a lot of these women, by the time that they actually try to find a husband and settle down and all that, it's maybe too late for them to have children. So that's what I think is so dangerous about feminism, is because they're feeding women this lie that they don't need marriage or a husband. And by the time a lot of these women realize it's not true, it's going to be too late for them. And I think a lot of women don't realize that, you know, pregnancy after 35, I'm not saying it doesn't happen or it can't happen, but it is medically a lot harder and more complicated than when you're younger.
So I want to ask you I'm going to throw out a couple of terms. I want to get your reaction to them because these have become very hot button issues in our society. So the first term is rape culture. And this is something that you hear about a lot on college campuses, people suggesting that we live in a rape culture, Democratic candidates for president suggesting that rape culture is predominant. What do you think of that phrase and where do you think we stand on all of this?
Well, I think rape culture is conceptually a real thing. I think it's possible to have a culture that either is condoning of or complicit in rape. I don't think that's Western culture, though. I mean, if I were to think of what rape culture is, honestly, Sharia law seems a lot more close to that, where women can actually be punished for being sexually assaulted, which is obviously not what Western law is about. But, you know, it's funny to me, for all of the complaining that feminism does about how rapey, misogynistic Western culture is, if we actually look at Hollywood culture or, you know, hip hop or rap culture, that's where women are being objectified, right? It's not the Christian conservatives who are objectifying women. Watch any rap video and you're going to see a lot more objectification than something that happens on like the Christian News Network or whatever. So that to me is a huge, huge double standard. I mean, these feminists, they're happy to complain about people like Mike Pence, but then they'll have, you know, all these hip hop artists, people like Jay-Z campaigning for Hillary Clinton as if they're some great, you know, respecters of women, which is absolutely not true. So, I mean, I don't think the progressive movement, the feminist movement actually cares about respecting women. I think they care about being anti, religious conservatives whenever convenient. If I were to choose a place where I would feel most uncomfortable as a woman alone, it would probably be the streets of, I don't know, any liberal part of California rather than, you know, a suburban place where people are by and large conservative.
I mean, this is one of the things that has always puzzled me about the left's claim to be great defenders of women. It's the same people who are against concealed carry, which seems to me the only way that women in many cases can even the odds against men who are trying to target them. And the left will similarly suggest that women should simply ignore realities of life. So if you are in a riskier situation or you put yourself in a riskier situation, you are therefore more at risk. That is not to justify the activity of evil men. But if I'm to walk in a high crime area waving my wallet around, that would not be a wise move, even if the person who robbed me is morally responsible for that. If you say the same thing about getting drunk at a bar and going home with a guy, then this is considered sexist in some way. And frankly, I don't understand the argument or how this protects women.
No, it doesn't at all. And I think the mistake that they're making is that these, and they really do act like this, that men who are rapists just don't know that they're rapists, right? That's why they have all these courses on college campuses, the don't rape courses, as if you could take like an 18-year-old male who for some reason thinks it's okay to rape and just tell him, oh, by the way, it's not. And he would be like, oh, I didn't know. Well then, there goes my evening plans. Like, oh, right? This is a problem that goes deeper than that. So, I mean, telling a woman that she shouldn't need to defend herself because we'll just tell men not to rape is like saying, oh, well, there's no point in locking your doors because people shouldn't be robbing you. Obviously, people shouldn't be robbing you, but that doesn't mean that you don't try to protect yourself. And this unwillingness on the part of the left to to be proactive in terms of protecting themselves, I think is also why they're so misguided on issues like the border and border security. They really do live in a lot of ways in this fantasy utopia where everyone is good. And if you just tell people, hey, stop that, then they'll listen and everything will be fine.
I mean, that kind of expansion of call-out culture, I feel, is sort of behind what's going on with, for example, Joe Biden. There's been no actual allegation that Joe Biden sexually assaulted or even harassed anybody. And yet Joe Biden is now being treated as apparently a sexual leper by a certain wing of the Democratic Party. It's kind of ironic to watch some Democrats come and defend that after they did the same thing to Brett Kavanaugh. But what do you make of the Joe Biden allegations? How seriously should we take allegations that he was handsy with women and smelling their hair and stuff like that?
Well, I think it's not just allegations that he was smelling their hair. Like, we have like kind of footage where he was being weird. Is it enough to say that he was sexually molesting them? I don't think so. I think we've known for a while that he's kind of like your creepy uncle who like is like touches your hair and is weird. That doesn't necessarily mean he's a rapist. I don't think we've seen enough evidence to suggest that. But I think what's happening is that it's not that all of a sudden, after all of his years in the spotlight, people are just like morally indignant about him touching women the way he is. I think what's happening is that he's polling very well in terms of the other like presidential hopeful candidates. And he does not, I guess, fit what they're trying to go for in terms of the oppression hierarchy, right? Because I think right now the top contenders are people like Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders, who are obviously white, male, and old. So I think right now what we're seeing is that they're willing to take shots at their own team if it means getting someone more intersectional to the top, someone like Kamala Harris or Cory Booker.
So let me give you another phrase here, believe all women. So we've heard this one a lot. And as a woman,
yeah.
Maybe you could speak to whether we should believe all women, under what circumstances we should believe all women. What exactly should that phrase mean? What does it mean?
Well, I think the thing with being a woman is that ovaries are not magical truth-telling orbs that prevent us from lying. That is not how that works. And I think a lot of where the believe all women type of thing stems from is that if someone comes to you and they claim that they're a survivor of rape or assault, you want to provide them with like comfort and care and et cetera, et cetera. Don't say that they're asking for it or whatever, which of course is true. If someone were personally to come to me and say that something terrible had happened to them, I would want to comfort them and on a personal level, be there for them, offer them assistance, whatever they needed. But when we're talking about a court of law and not just believing someone's own personal experience that something bad had happened to them, but then taking that allegation and saying that someone is guilty of assaulting another person, that's a different story. And I think when we look at what happened with the whole Brett Kavanaugh thing, no, a woman's statement is not enough to completely ruin a man's career or life. Because the thing with Western culture is that we take rape seriously. Being called a rapist is one of the worst things that someone could be. I think you'd agree, right? Like, that's awful. And it's because we take such a strong stance against rape that we need to be very, very careful with believing statements that don't have any backing. Now, I think when I say stuff like that, I always get the issue like, okay, what about the Weinsteins of the world? Or, you know, who was the comedian? He was recently convicted, I think.
Well, Louis C.K. was kind of ousted.
No, but the one from the 80s.
Oh, Bill Cosby.
Bill Cosby. Yeah.
Like, I can tell you're young when you're forgetting Bill Cosby's name. Yeah.
Bill Cosby. What about people like that? You know, I mean, it's the kind of thing. It's like any crime. Don't believe any gossip you hear. But if there's actually like substantiated accounts that go back for a while and individual witnesses that are able to corroborate, then that's one thing. But what we're seeing is that, especially in the age of social media, a single tweet or Facebook post is enough to ruin people's lives. And I think we really need to scale back the witch hunt mentality that we have, because people are getting hurt. And I think what some people have suggested, and I would support, is if people are filing police reports that end up being proven to be false, there definitely needs to be some sort of penalty for that.
Okay, so here's another term for you, and you've been very critical of this one, hookup culture. So we've moved away from a relationship-based culture and toward more sexual freedom. You're very critical of hookup culture. Why?
I'm critical of hookup culture because I'm pro-woman, and I think ultimately hookup culture is not good for women. And I'm not saying that any woman who goes out and sleeps with someone, you know, has been victimized or that her life is ruined or anything like that. No, but I think that women are not the same as men. It's obvious. We know this scientifically. Sex does not have the same meaning for men by and large as it does for women. And, you know, trying to teach women that they can go out and have sex with an unending number of men and it's not going to affect them emotionally or psychologically is actually not true. We've seen studies that promiscuity has lasting effects on both genders, but especially women. It can lead to things like a depression, low self-esteem, and things like that. And actually, they've done studies where they look at the total number of sexual partners women have had before marriage, and it does affect her likelihood of getting divorced. So, I mean, I get called a prude and stuff, and that's not what this is about. But I think if we want women to be making informed decisions with their own lives, which I would have thought feminism should be about, then we need to be realistic about what hookup culture does mean. I mean, not to mention the fact that with STDs and things, and actually if you want women to be protected from things like sexual abuse and harassment, I think part of that is not putting yourself in dangerous positions. So it's so weird. Like we live in an era where it's deemed too personal to call people on the phone versus texting. Yet going into a club and sleeping with a stranger is totally fine. It's like we kind of need to reevaluate where our moral compass is.
I mean, this
is
has always been puzzling to me. When you watch TV now, there's a vast difference between how sex is treated. It used to be that the way that things typically went in the movies was you fall in love with somebody, you marry them, and then there's a cut to the curtains, right? And now the way that it works is that people hop in the sack with each other. And then there's this awkward moment in every sitcom where after they've slept together, one of them turns to them and says, I love you. And that's the real moment. That's the intimacy.
Like,
that's where everyone's like, oh no, you said I love. Well, that's just, wow, that's too intimate.
Yeah.
You just had sex with the person.
And I think the thing with hookup culture is that I'm actually, I've had feminists kind of like smirk at this, but I really hate when men behave gross toward women. I hate lewd behavior. I hate it. Like, I will leave a situation if that's happening. And I think what frustrates me about hookup culture is that a lot of guys are being rewarded that way because it does work on some women, which makes it just unpleasant for the rest of us. So I would like, and again, people are going to be like, oh, you're such a prude, but I would like sex to mean something in our culture. And especially, you know, I'm pro-life. And I think part of the pro-life argument shouldn't involve the fact that unplanned pregnancies are happening way too often and they shouldn't be happening as often as they are. And they've actually done studies and, you know, women who encounter unplanned pregnancies who are married in serious relationships, they're a lot less likely to even seek out that abortion because, you know, they have stability. They're with a partner that they can depend on. So, you know, for those reasons, for family, for women, for children, I just think that we really need to rein back the crazy, like, pro-sex, sex-positive, whatever they're calling it, roller coaster we've been on.
Also worth noting that just for the record, social science statistics tend to show that women in committed relationships have more and better sex than women who are not in committed relationships because women are actually seeking emotional intimacy and comfort as opposed to men who tend to seek variety for evolutionary reasons. So let's talk a little bit about dating. So you are now engaged. Mm-hmm. So let's have some advice for young women who are looking to get engaged, who are looking to get married. What exactly should they be looking for in a guy?
Be with a guy that wants the same things that you want. I think a lot of guys out there, a lot of women out there too, unfortunately, they're not looking for things like marriage or children or whatever. I've been called too picky for saying this, but it's absolutely true. If you are committed to getting married and having kids, then you need to be looking for someone who wants the same things that you do. So, you know, there are a lot of great people out there and there are a lot of guys you might meet and date and have fun with. But at the end of the day, if he's not interested in marriage and children, then don't think that you can change him into being whoever you want. So definitely prioritize someone who wants the same things that you do in life.
It seems to me that for a lot of young women who I see who are unhappy, this is true for young men too, but it's certainly true for young women, that a lot of the unhappiness springs from a certain war with reality, that men are not what they want men to be. What do you think it is that women don't generally understand about men? Like if you had to sum up men as a half of the species in a few sentences, what do you think it is that men are? What do men want?
I think men ultimately, and this is probably not true for a good number of men who have, like women, been influenced by third wave feminism, but men traditionally have wanted to be protectors and providers for their families. So I think ultimately a lot of women my age, we look at men and we might see that kind of behavior as, I don't know, belittling or benevolently sexist or things like that, which is too bad because I think relationships work best when people aren't the same, but rather when they complement each other. So I think with men, women kind of need to be a little bit more aware that he's not just going to be like one of your girlfriends. He's going to be different and that's okay. And you shouldn't be trying to make him into one of your girlfriends or make him as feminine as possible. Relationships work best when you when you kind of, you accept the other person. It doesn't mean you're going to think they're perfect in any way, but don't try to fundamentally change the personality or beliefs of your partner, because that's just not going to work.
And what do you think it is that young men don't understand about women? Because obviously we're seeing people getting married later and later. That's having some pretty terrible consequences for the society, less responsibility taking. But what do men not get about women? If you could tell guys out there what to expect from women, what exactly would you be telling them?
This is a really hard question, because I look at modern women and I feel like I don't understand them. And I forget who said this quote, but what is it? The only people who understand women are other women, and they hate them. So it's like, I don't really know what to say to that. But I think for men, if you can find a woman who's got similar values as you, then I think something that I'm really happy my fiance understands about me is that we are not going to have the same, we're not going to have the same, I guess, outlook as you guys do when it comes to things like money and career, and that's okay, right? Because I notice even, like, I'll have people in interviews ask me, like, where do you want to be in, like, 5 years or 10 years? And honestly, all of my plans long-term revolve around family and relationships. And, you know, for a while, I would feel really bad about that, but it's like, well, that's, you know, I'm a young woman who wants to get married and have kids, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And I think men nowadays, a lot of men do find that kind of strange, but it's, I mean, historically, it's really par for the course.
Yeah, one of the things that I've found also when it comes to relationships, and this actually is a great observation by Andrew Klavan, another one of the hosts over here, is that when people are dating, there's this constant refrain, I can't find Mrs. Right, I can't find Mr. Right. And he's always saying, well, if you're looking for Miss Right, maybe you're not Mr. Right. Maybe you need to make yourself better in some way. How do you think that men should train themselves to be more attractive to women? How do you think they should train themselves to be more masculine?
Oh, I've done videos about this, and I've made a lot of people really angry. Because, like, I've done dating videos, and anytime I do, I get, like, a lot of, like, really angry, for lack of a better word. I mean, the even self-avowed incels or MGTOW people who say I have no right to be giving advice to anybody on this because I am a female and, young, and I look a certain way, so therefore I should. But anyway, you've asked me, so I feel
I've asked me.
I'm blaming you.
Incels can attack me. They do anyway. It's fine.
I think ultimately women, and studies have shown this, are attracted to things like confidence and success. And if you're a guy who is looking for a girlfriend, honestly, the best thing that you can do is be comfortable and assured with yourself. Like, don't, I guess, put on fake confidence, but become the type of person where you have actual traits and accomplishments that you can genuinely be confident about. So that goes for, you know, school or even personal achievement. Be someone who is, like, happy and upbeat, who provides and is a benefit to your friends and family. That's something that I think any girl is going to be attracted to.
And on the other side, what's your advice for young women who are looking for somebody, how to improve themselves so that they're more attractive to men if they're interested in getting married?
You know what's funny? I have a lot of male viewers, and anytime I talk about dating, I am shocked and made so sad by the number of them who say that what they really want is a girl to settle down with, to have kids with, but so many females that they're around have really bought into the whole third wave feminism thing. So they're not looking for families or a serious relationship even, or children. So I think if you are a girl who's interested in that, don't be afraid of talking about it. I know it's like this taboo now where you're not supposed to, like, even mention the word marriage early on in a relationship. And I'm not saying to try to get married on the first date, but you, like, don't be afraid of people knowing that, yeah, you want to get married, you're dating with purpose. Because some guys might be scared off by that, but the right type of guy will see that as a positive. So it's great. It's kind of like a self-fulfilling thing. You're going to get rid of all the people who aren't interested in the same things that you are.
Yeah, well, I totally agree with this. In fact, I will say it. You should talk marriage on the first date, because otherwise there's no reason to be dating in the first place. Well, I'm frankly confused by people who date for fun. Like, I understand if you're just looking for sex, okay, I get it. But if you are dating for fun, I'm not sure what's fun about dating.
I hate dating. I get super nervous. My palms are sweaty. It's really bad. I hate it. And, you know, it's the same thing when my fiance and I started dating. We didn't get engaged really soon. It's not like we were rushing things. But yeah, the first few dates, how many kids do you want? Okay, that's cool. Do you plan on keeping your own last name? No, good. You know, that kind of thing. So at least we can see that we're on the same page before it's worth going further. Because otherwise, I feel really bad for these women who kind of spend 5 years in a relationship and then, like, oh yeah, he didn't actually want to get married. And it's like,
Dating is not supposed to be comfortable. Yeah. Dating is supposed to be uncomfortable because it is, in fact, a testing process of the other person to determine whether this is someone you want to spend the rest of your life with. And if you're too comfortable dating, then I would suggest either you don't have enough stake in the person you are dating because you don't want to marry them, or you're not taking dating itself seriously enough. I remember I didn't date my wife for very long. We've now been married for almost 11 years. She was 20 at the time. I was 23 when we first met. And we dated for 3.5 months before we were engaged. And I was ready to get married 2.5 months in, I remember. Mm-hmm. And she knew that. And so she held off on saying, I love you, to me, because she knew as soon as she said, I love you, I was going to say, okay, so let's get married. And I remember when that finally happened, when I said, let's get married, she said, why can't we just enjoy this time? And I said, because I'm not enjoying this time. This time is terrible. Like, let's get married. And then then that's when the fun happens. And that happens to be true. There's this myth that I think has been created by unhappy married people in some cases about the wonders of single life. And I fail to see the wonders of single life. I was single. It sucked. Mm-hmm. Being married is much better.
Yeah. And I think part of the reason why people are kind of delaying marriage or even not getting married at all is because marriage used to mean something, right? I'm excited to get married because I want to live with my husband/fiance. I want that. That's going to be fun. I want to be able to have kids. But nowadays, I mean, people are living together without being married. People are having kids without being married. So from that standpoint, they're like, well, why bother to get married? And it's like, well, because there is still something special to marriage. And I get a lot of, people who are cohabiting that get mad at me when I say that. But if you look at the, the abuse rates of cohabiting couples, and not just that, but the, I guess, like rates of staying together of cohabiting couples, it is not a synonym for marriage. At all. There is a difference.
Well, that's right. I mean, once you've actually put some skin in the game, which is what marriage is, that's a very mm-hmm. different thing. Cohabiting is still leaving the window open in case you feel like climbing out in the middle of the night from my generalized perspective.
Right.
Not true for every specific, true in general. So let's talk about your religious background, because you used to be an atheist. Now mm-hmm. you're a religious person. So what's your religious background?
So I grew up in sort of like a Christmas, Easter Catholic household. I mean, I would have said that I was Catholic. I went to Bible studies when I was a kid. I drew like crayon Jesuses. I have memories of that. But ultimately, like, I can never remember like really having any deep religious thoughts or spiritual thoughts. And that was kind of me younger than growing up. When I was 13, I remember I started this like angsty atheist phase. I was reading like Richard Dawkins, and I just thought I knew better than everybody. Like, yeah, all of these religious scholars from like thousands of years ago, they don't know what I know, okay? I'm a 13-year-old atheist, so pretty big deal. So that was me, and I really thought that I knew better than everybody. And I was quite obnoxious during those years, but as I got older, I started to be interested in philosophy a little bit more. So I started reading people like Plato and Aristotle, and it's funny, I actually became sort of a deist before I circled back to Christianity at all. But, you know, theories like the theory of the cave, unmoved mover, it made me start questioning things. And it's not, you know, there's this belief that if you're religious, you're anti-science. I'm not anti-science, but I think ultimately science is the how but not the why. We can believe in the Big Bang Theory but still think, okay, well, then what was the catalyst for that? Then what was before that, right? Because ultimately science is not, it's not a system that can explain to us anything qualitative or explain why. So I started to be a little bit more open to the idea of a creator God. And then as I got a little bit older still, I started exploring things like, St. Aquinas, and I got more interested in the Bible. And what's interesting about Christianity is that if you believe in the ultimate good, like the theory of forms, which is a big part of my like philosophical belief even now, you can't help but recognize that human beings or the world around us, we fall short in so many ways of attaining that perfect, that ultimate good. Christianity, and really, it's the backbone of, I think, all Abrahamic religions. They recognize that fault and they try to find a solution to it. Like, why are humans falling short? What can we do to become perfect? Because I think, I mean, ultimately, the trouble that I think a lot of atheists have is that they recognize that we aren't perfect, that society isn't perfect, but they don't have an answer for it. Right. Oftentimes the answer is, OK, well, maybe more government, that will make us perfect. Or, maybe this medicine, this drug, then will be perfect. They're trying to find all of these solutions. But I think ultimately Christianity for me is the only philosophy or theology where I can say that makes the most sense. And so that when I was 16 or 17, I became a born again Christian. And I think since then it's been, you always try to grow in your faith, but it's a struggle. You go back, you go forward sometimes. And I, for the most part of my channel, I never really talked about being a Christian. And I only really started talking about it fairly recently because I realized that there are so many people out there, and this is kind of depressing, who have such a negative view of religion or religious people. And the United States, the West in general, is still a majority of people profess some sort of religious affiliation. But if you were to, I guess, judge things based off of YouTube or Twitter comments, you wouldn't know that. You would think they're the minority and that everyone's an atheist. So for me, talking about things like religion, spirituality, or faith, it's a way to try and at least, this is going to sound weird, but normalize it, because there are so many young people, millennials especially, who have had no exposure to any type of religion. So they're very much of the belief that religion is bad, religion makes you stupid. If you're religious, that's because you've never opened a science book. Like, evolution exists, checkmate, theists, that kind of thing. So that's what I'm trying to push back on. I really like that you talk about your faith as well, because no one can call you stupid, right? I mean, people can call you wrong, but they can't call you stupid.
Well, they try anyway, but thank you. I appreciate that. So you're obviously, you know, self-educated in a lot of ways, and it sounds like you did a lot of reading on your own. What would be your reading list for somebody who's looking to become educated about politics or philosophy?
Ooh, that's a hard one. So I think if it comes to something like philosophy, then I would recommend reading The Republic. So that my moniker for my channel used to be like Philosopher King, because that was kind of like a joke. But actually, if you read The Republic, it's quite almost like totalitarian in nature. So I wouldn't advocate that. But I think like the Platonic idea of like happiness and justice is something that I find really interesting. And if we look about how do we achieve happiness, which is what our culture is struggling to do in so many ways. We've gone down the route, I think, of hedonism and nihilism. But if you look at the ancient Greek philosophy about how we can achieve justice or meaning or purpose, it's by fulfilling our roles. And so in my own personal life, that's what I find has given me the most meaning, right? I look at all of my roles and I ask myself how I can fulfill those better. You know, my role as a fiance, my role as a daughter, my role as a Christian, as a show host. And to me, that is something that I can find meaning in. So there's that. And I think, let's see, 1984 is a really good one that I think is pretty topical. That it's funny, when I was reading that in high school, I thought, like, okay, well, this is stupid. I don't see the point. But I think it's becoming more and more relevant. Hannah Arendt on totalitarianism is also another one that I would recommend that I think is kind of especially relevant today. Because you talk about the issue of atomization that I think we're undergoing right now in society. People are becoming cut off from their families, their communities, their cultures. And when you do that, the only meaningful connection you have left is toward the state. And I think that's a problem that a lot of millennials have. They're not really engaged in their real life. The only meaningful sense of loyalty they have is maybe to some unseen government or state benefit program. And I think that can lead us down a pretty dark path.
So let's talk about culture, because you're obviously engaged with the culture. So I'm just going to ask you about some of the stuff that's out there right now. You're apparently like an award-winning Game of Thrones quiz champion.
Yeah, according to QuizUp, I am.
Wow.
That's quite the award. I get a little banner on my QuizUp app now.
What were you? You were like number one in Utah?
Yeah, pretty big deal.
Are you the only person in Utah who watches Game of Thrones?
There's like several other people, I feel.
Okay, that's good. So where is it going this season, and how are you feeling about the last season?
Okay, I really didn't like the last season. I think there were huge pacing issues. I mean, season one, it felt like it went on too long, but then by the last seasons, like people are going back and forth between Westeros and Essos in like a single episode. It didn't make sense. That's because the showrunners, like, they weren't into it. They want to get onto new project, but that's a whole thing. So ultimately, I think John and Dany are going to get together and have a baby. There was some major heavy-handed foreshadowing that she's not actually barren. So I think that's going to happen. I'm still hoping that Daenerys is going to go like evil queen route, like the Mad King, and need to be killed. That's what I'm hoping for, because I'm not a fan. I hope that Tyrion or Jon Snow ends up on the Iron Throne. But I'm not too sure of that. I'm pretty sure Tyrion's going to have some like epic but depressing self-sacrificing moment that might leave Jon Snow. Arya, not a total fan of, couldn't really be fussed either way. And let's see what else. I hope that Jaime finds redemption, because he's someone who I actually really like as a character now, which is funny because the way this show started out, was not a fan.
He's definitely, he will find redemption. He will end up killing Cersei.
Yeah.
Right, obviously. I mean, they're foreshadowing too heavily that it's going to be him who kills her.
And yeah, do you ship him and Brienne?
It's kind of fun.
Yeah.
I mean, like, yeah, I guess. I don't really care about that, is the truth. I like Brienne. I like him. I don't really care if they're together at all. Also, he's definitely going to plot. So he's going to die.
Yeah.
That is coming. My great fear is that this will end with the Republic, which would just suck. That it'll end up being that Jon will have to recede into the West because he's died before and he can't actually be on the Iron Throne. And that Tyrion, who, by the way, is terrible at everything. I mean, let me just point out, Tyrion is the worst advisor in Westeros. He's a garbage advisor. He was a bad advisor to Cersei. He was a bad advisor to his father. He was a bad advisor to Daenerys. and now he's a bad advisor to John. Like, he's a terrible advisor every way around, and he keeps saying that he says smart things and drinks. I'm only seeing the drinking, I'll be frank with you. So if Tyrion ends up on the Iron Throne after all this, I will be quite disappointed with that. But, you know, there's not that much time left. So honestly, my big question is how they even fill the rest of the time. Because it feels like there's climactic battle with the White Walkers that is coming. Yeah. You could probably knock that out in an episode. And then the only thing I cared about was all the non-magical stuff. Actually, it's kind of ticked me off that the show has moved into too much magical stuff and not enough of the politicking, which I always thought was interesting.
Yeah, well, they have the battle with the White Walkers needs to happen. There's also the battle with the Iron Islanders that also needs to happen.
No one cares about that.
That's, I really don't.
Also, like, when did Cersei... Everyone's doing stupid things. They got rid of all the smart characters. This is my main problem
with the
show.
Oh, yeah, Cersei's pregnant.
She's pregnant again?
She's pregnant again.
Okay, well, that's fine. But they keep killing off all of these smart characters. So I was a big Tywin fan because Tywin actually thought before he did stuff.
I was a big Stannis fan.
Right, before, and totally turned child sacrificial.
I know, which was like total character flip because
correct.
He was the only one that cared about his daughter.
And also, he definitely had the best actual legal claim to the Iron Throne.
Yeah.
So there's that.
We're both INTJs.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. So, yeah, and finally, Cersei is not clever. Man, and then they got rid of what's her face, the old woman, the Olenna.
Oh yeah, Olenna.
Olenna Tyrell. Yeah, they got rid of all the smart characters and they retained all the dumb ones, and so it's going to be dumb people doing dumb things. And,
yeah, that's how I feel about Sansa. I'm really not invested in her character.
No, and by the way, the way that they took out Littlefinger at the end of last season.
That was
your trick.
Yeah.
He's the smartest guy in Westeros, and you took him out with, like, you were hiding in the shadows? That's how that
worked?
You
called a meeting, and then he came. Checkmate.
Boom.
Yeah.
Okay, so now I have to ask you about Avengers Infinity War. So that is coming out in
Endgame.
The next... Endgame, thank you. So where is Endgame going to go?
Okay, well, we know from whose contracts have been renewed and whose hasn't. Well, they already announced another Spider-Man movie, so shocker.
Shock.
Black Panther... I mean,
he's gonna
come back. Chris Evans, Iron Man, I don't think they're gonna make it. The Hulk, I've not been thrilled with the storyline either way lately, so I couldn't care less. I'm interested mostly to see how big a role that Captain Marvel is gonna play, because this is maybe like tinfoil hat conspiracy stuff, but the rumors have it that Marvel actually ended up filming two different versions of the movie, depending on how her movie was received, that would kind of dictate how big a role that she has. I don't know if that's true, but that's just what people on the Reddit have been saying. So that movie ended up doing pretty well, despite
I didn't see it. Have you seen it?
I did see it.
Okay,
a lot of people were angry that I saw it, but I did see it. It's okay. It is okay. Like, it's not the worst thing ever, and it's not some sort of, like, long intersectional feminist ode to how awful straight white men are. I mean, it's not none of that girl power messaging, but it's okay. I think I saw it because I really wanted to understand Endgame. I think ultimately you can watch Endgame without having seen it and you're probably going to be fine.
Okay, good, because that's sort of my plan.
Yeah.
So I didn't see any driving force behind seeing Captain Marvel other than people would want me to review it, and then now I really don't want to, because when people want me to review things, it makes me not want to review those things. Okay, so with all of this culture talk, how do conservatives get involved in the culture? Because, you know, it's easy to get us into the political sphere. We sort of naturally exist there.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to get us into the religious sphere. Obviously, we exist there as well. How do conservatives get involved in sort of the cultural sphere without it seeming forced or ridiculous?
Well, I think conservatives just need to be more comfortable writing and producing cultural works. And what's kind of frustrating is that I know for so many conservatives or conservative families, like, the last thing you want your child to do is go into the entertainment industry, right? As someone with an Asian father, trust me, that was like not on the table. It was like doctor, different type of doctor or lawyer. I think I understand that, because as conservatives, naturally, we value things like stability, economic security, and things like that, which is not conducive to the entertainment industry. But at the same time, I think if all of us are too scared to produce any sorts of artistic works ourselves, then we can't really complain that anything Hollywood makes is super liberal, because it's like we've kind of given them that sphere. I think it's really cool that you've written fiction before. Andrew Klavan, of course, like he does fiction and stuff as well. I encourage that. I think more conservatives need to be comfortable taking that leap. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is that if there is a movie or a series that you really like, not necessarily because it's conservative, but because it doesn't really shove a totally left-wing bias, then support it, share it, because I feel like maybe conservatives aren't as good as people on the left are at promoting movies that they care about. And, you know, Unplanned is something that's come out now that I really enjoy seeing how conservatives have rallied around, because if conservative movies don't do well, then it makes sense no one's going to keep making them. And actually, I don't know, have you seen A Quiet Place?
Yes.
Yeah, so that's the movie that I really, really enjoyed, and even my fiancé, who is notoriously hateful of anything Hollywood makes, had to say, yeah, that's a pretty good movie. And it's not even something that's explicitly conservative. And, you know, both of the actors, John Krasinski and his wife, Emily Blunt, you know, they're not conservative or anything by any means. But in that movie, it portrays a father and a wife, and the father takes care of his family, and the wife kind of fulfills that nurturing role, which...
And it's an inherently pro-life film.
It is. Right. It really is. So that's another thing where it's like, yeah, that was a good movie. And no overtly liberal or feminist messages. Yeah, let's support that.
That's one area where it seems like millennials may be moving in a more conservative direction on abortion. Do you feel that?
I kind of do, because it's funny. As someone who's pro-life, I'm so often told that I reject science and I'm only pro-life because of religion, which is actually not true. Because science is on the pro-life side. There is no scientific fact that I've seen pro-choice people make aside from my body, my choice, which is funny because any other issue, these progressive feminists don't really seem to be in favor of choice and limited government. But when it comes to abortion, all of a sudden they are. So science and biology is very firmly on the side of the pro-life people. And I think, you know, the more we educate people on fetal development and things like that, the more we can kind of drive home the pro-life side of things, because, I mean, frankly, I don't think you even need to bring religion into it to make a pro-life argument. You really, really don't. And I'm someone who I never really thought of it much, but I didn't have a problem with abortion before I started learning about biology and just how quickly things like the heartbeat, the brain system and everything forms. So that's something we need to get better at communicating.
Well, that is one area where Unplanned really does its heavy work. I mean, there's really, all you really have to watch is the one scene where they actually show an abortion in progress in Unplanned. And then that's why it earned an R rating. Matt Walsh made a great point about this. He said, if they'd been showing a gallbladder surgery, that's PG-13. Yeah. So obviously even the critics and the censors who were deciding how to exactly to rate this thing, they wanted to rate it R because they recognized there was a moral value to what was happening on screen. So let's talk about, you mentioned briefly before sort of the censorious nature of the internet left. You've had to deal with some of that.
Yeah.
Have you dealt with the left that is come after you in particular, and they've come after you in some peculiar ways. They've suggested that because you've interviewed some fringe figures that somehow this makes you fringe. How do you determine who it is that you are willing to give a platform or interview yourself?
Yeah, well, I think for me is that I'm interested in huge cultural movements. You know, I've interviewed Richard Spencer before at a time when, by the way, they don't really bring this up, but Richard Spencer had already been on CNN and Al Jazeera before he was ever on my platform. So, like, let's make it clear. I was a YouTuber with maybe 100,000 subscribers. So if anyone was giving anyone a signal boost, it was not me giving him a signal boost. But I think the thing is, I'm someone who, if someone has a huge movement behind them, I think they are worth listening to, if at least for understanding them. I would love to be able to interview someone like Tariq Nasheed or Anita Sarkeesian, you know, these far left figures. The thing is that they don't really seem very keen to engage. And I know you've had a problem with that, you know, trying to get someone to debate you or just engage.
Discuss
with
would you. Be fine, yeah.
Yeah, or yeah, discuss even. A lot of people who are on the far left don't want that. So personally, I don't think we can combat an ideology unless we understand it. And there was, I think, Dinesh D'Souza, he made a video about, or he did something on the alt-right, and he actually interviewed, I think, Richard Spencer, and he came out that, yeah, Richard Spencer is a socialist, essentially. He is a white nationalist Bernie supporter. And I remember when that came out, everyone was like, oh, what? He's not actually on the right? Like, what? And I was like, I interviewed him like a year and a half ago, and we talked about the same thing. Like, I've known this for a long time. And I think one of the reasons why the left especially doesn't want us understanding the alt-right is because the alt-right, they're essentially white Black Lives Matter. They are, it's the same racial identitarianism. So seeing that, the similarities that they have, doesn't make their side look very good. And it especially doesn't make them look very good when they're trying to blame us for creating the alt-right. So when people say that kind of stuff, 9 times out of 10, they haven't actually watched the interview. You know, I say in that interview that I'm not a white nationalist. I don't agree with you. I don't know how much more upfront I can be about it. So I've kind of just, I tune it out because I think there are people that want to engage with you, honestly, and there are people who don't. And I've learned that if someone is just keen on calling you a Nazi, there's not really anything you can do to move
past
that.
It's a badly motivated argument. You can see it now being used in mainstream circles. They've brought up this ridiculous study that suggests that because all of us are on YouTube, basically, and because there are a lot of us who are popular on YouTube, if people watch a bunch of those videos, eventually they fall down a rabbit hole, a small minority of them, and that is somehow the fault of Dave Rubin or me or Jordan Peterson or Joe Rogan or you. And that's really an attempt to just fringe out anybody who is having conversations in any way, even critical conversations that need to be had. And more importantly, they don't care about fringing out Richard Spencer, who's fringed himself out. They care about fringing out mainstream popular figures who happen to be heterodox, because Jordan is not necessarily conservative. Joe Rogan certainly is not conservative. Dave Rubin is a classical liberal, as he likes to call himself. And yet there's this move to try and shrink the Overton window so that everybody who is not a Hillary Clinton supporter or a Barack Obama supporter is outside that Overton window now.
Yeah, and that's what's frustrating to me is that, I mean, like with the whole Christchurch thing, everyone was going after the right wing because it's hashtag not all Muslims, but it is hashtag all right wingers, conveniently. And they spent a lot more time demonizing figures like you or Jordan Peterson than the actual white nationalists. And that's always so funny to me is that, I mean, let's say for some whatever, we can say that, you know, this Orthodox Jew is leading people toward the alt-right. Wouldn't that still lead you to criticize the actual alt-right more? And they just don't. I don't know why that is. If they find these ideas so repugnant, then shouldn't you be actually criticizing the people who are espousing them, taking apart white nationalist arguments, not just conservative arguments? But they really don't spend any time doing that, which is, I mean, you and, you know, Michael Knowles with his video for prayer, you guys have spent more time denouncing the alt-right than they have, like the actual alt-right.
Yeah, no, it is pretty amazing. And Jordan, too. I mean, there are a number of us who have spent an enormous amount of time fighting white nationalism. But if there's a convenient way to fight back against people they don't like, then they will use any club at their disposal. And it really is fundamentally dishonest. Okay, so I do have one more question for you, and we'll get to that in just one second. But first, you actually have to be a subscriber. If you want to hear Lauren Chen's answer, and I'm going to ask her about Canadian politics because she has some fluency with handsome Bernie Sanders, Justin Trudeau, you have to be a Daily Wire subscriber. To subscribe, go to dailywire.com, click subscribe. You can hear the end of our conversation over there. Well, Lauren Chen, thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate your time. If you want to check out Lauren's stuff, then head on over to The Blaze TV, where you have a show, Pseudo-Intellectual. Lauren, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
The Ben Shapiro Show Sunday Special is produced by Jonathan Hay, executive producer Jeremy Boring, associate producer Mathis Glover, edited by Donovan Fowler. Audio is mixed by Dylan Case. Hair and makeup is by Jesua Olvera. Title graphics by Cynthia Angulo. The Ben Shapiro Show Sunday Special is a Daily Wire production. Copyright Daily Wire 2019.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.